And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still question the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer. It's the answer told by lines that stretched around schools and churches in numbers this nation has never seen, by people who waited 3 hours and 4 hours, many for the first time in their lives, because they believed that this time must be different, that their voices could be that difference. It's the answer spoken by young and old, rich and poor, Democrat and Republican, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, Native American, gay, straight, disabled and not disabled, Americans who sent a message to the world that we have never been just a collection of individuals or a collection of red states and blue states. We are and always will be the United States of America.
That, of course, is President-elect Barack Obama, the soon-to-be 44th President of the United States. I don't know about you, but I'm still in a bit of shock. I'm still reliving the moment. I'm going back using my TiVo, and in fact, just a few minutes ago, maybe half an hour ago, I rewatched Barack Obama's acceptance speech. And the hope is infectious. I mean, I cried a second time. You know, I guess I shouldn't be such a wuss, but I did. I admit it. I couldn't help it. There's such a magical moment when something like this happens, where you think that all things are possible. I remember I felt that way in 92, the only other time I've ever felt that way in my political history, when Bill Clinton was elected. Remember, he was the man from hope. The idea of hope is not new to Barack Obama. I was excited that way then. I think I'm more excited now, if that's possible. I think it is. Barack Obama strikes me, and you know, it may just be me, like most Americans, putting into his head, you know, all my hopes and dreams. I do recognize somewhere in the cynical, dark recesses of the brain that he will disappoint me. I know that to be true intellectually. I do not know that to be true emotionally. Emotionally, in my heart, this is a man that will fulfill all my dreams. I've never had a president elected that I supported in the primaries as well as in the general election before. I mean, that's also something new. In 2004, I supported Wesley Clark against John Kerry, and John Kerry against George Bush. Of course, they both lost. I did support Al Gore in the primaries in 2000, and he won the election, but never became president. In 92, I supported Paul Tsongas because I thought Bill Clinton was a little squirrely. Didn't quite trust him completely. But Obama, as you know, if you've listened to my show, was someone who I thought long and hard over before endorsing him over Hillary Clinton, who I still like and admire and have a great deal of respect for, and I think would have made a terrific president. But Obama will be better. I'm quite happy in my choice, both in the primary and in the general election. And when I look out at Grant Park in Chicago and see all those faces again, black and white, young and old, and Asian and Hispanic and Latino and Jewish and gay and straight and union members and veterans and, you know, Wall Street types in their suits and hard workers with dirt under their fingernails, just all of America, everybody, waving the flag. And it it is a time for optimism in the deep, dark recesses of, let's face it, one of the worst crises in American history, economic and war and the nasty lawlessness that we're trying to get past in the Bush era. There really are only a few elections in American history that really promised great change. Probably the first one was the election of 1800. You know me, I'm always a bit of a historian. I'm always looking back into history. But think how dark it was for supporters of a more direct democracy under Thomas Jefferson when in 1798 and 1799, President John Adams was literally putting people in jail for disagreeing with him. The Sedition Act. And yet Thomas Jefferson won a bitter. You think this election was tough? Take a look at the election of 1800. Vicious election. Thomas Jefferson won, and ever since that time, we haven't had a president put someone in jail for disagreeing with him. Though this president came close. We had Richard Nixon, of course, break into headquarters of Democrats who disagreed with him, political opponents. And then we have this president who spied on every one of us and did put in jail two Americans without trial, without access to attorneys, and countless non-Americans. This president didn't quite go to the Sedition Act of John Adams, but he sure came close in his lawlessness, appointing prosecutors that would go out and put terrific political leaders like Don Siegelman, governor of Alabama, a Democratic governor of one of the reddest states in the nation, and literally had to put him in jail in order to stop him from running for re-election. Karl Rove, indeed, put a slew of lawless, nasty political operatives, far worse, I got to say, than anything Richard Nixon had done, into government. But now, with the election of Barack Obama, I feel like, well, just a fresh air, cool breeze wafting in. You know how when you're, I don't know, in some deep, dark, disgusting place, it could be a bathroom at a filling station. It could be a kitchen where there's all kinds of acrid odors because somebody burnt something. It could be a hot, sweaty, slimy, smoggy, you know how it gets when you're in a room with 1,000 people and there's not enough air conditioning. And it smells a bit of body odor. And then you walk outside the bathroom, the kitchen, the crowded, sweaty place, and it's a beautiful day. There's a cool breeze. The sun is shining, and the birds are singing, and all's right with the world again. You know, I'm an incurable optimist. I am. I have every reason to be cynical. I came to Washington because my country was hijacked, because of the Supreme Court coup d'etat of 2000, because the American people voted for, that even the citizens of Florida voted for in the majority, Al Gore, didn't get to be president of the United States because of corruption, because of vicious, tyrannical corruption. And yet, I am the ultimate optimist. I've never, ever, never given up on my country. I do believe in the American dream. I do believe in the hope of American democracy. I do believe in every single thing Barack Obama said. Yes, we can. And I've heard the doubters. I've talked with many, many of you. And I'm not dissing you. Please don't take this as an insult. But let's face it. Many radio listeners have called into my show in the depth of the horrors of the Cheney-Rove administration and their puppet George Bush, and have said impossible things about America. They've said that, you know, we can't get rid of these people, that we can never have a fair election again, that these tyrants will rule forever, that there's just no hope. And Barack Obama brought us that hope. And American democracy worked. And for all the imperfections of our country, and God knows, I mention them often, We are far from perfect. We are creating a more perfect union. And while I think all of us understand the unique tears of African Americans in this election, God, even an old soldier like Colin Powell was drawn to tears. That's something. That's something. I mean, Oprah Winfrey, it was moving to see her cry, but yeah, she cries at everything. Watching Colin Powell cry, that was moving. Or John Lewis. But African Americans weren't the only ones crying. People like me, people like you, people across America who believe in hope and change and the future and the American dream, we saw something. We see something. I'm almost a little afraid by all the infectious optimism around. Afraid that Barack Obama, since he is a man and not a messiah, may not be able to achieve all we hope he will achieve. I hope that all of us understand that and give the guy a bit of a break. Give him some time. But I suspect he'll hit the ground running. And I suspect he'll do so with a discipline that, well, that we've seen in his campaign. If there's one thing about Barack Obama that Americans learned that I don't think they knew until a few months ago, is that this guy is cool under pressure. And everybody knows it now. And not just in comparison to the erratic John McCain running and changing his strategy and going from one place to the next and saying, oh, I'll cancel my campaign to go to Washington to save the financial crisis. Skip the debates. Have the debates. Do the debates. Don't do the debates. In fact, there's an interesting article coming out in New York Times Magazine. It hasn't come out yet, but I encourage everyone to read it. I certainly will read it. That talks about the fact that Sarah Palin was chosen on a whim. I guess that shouldn't surprise any of us. John McCain was going to choose Joe Lieberman. And what a different election that would have been. I want to talk about Joe Lieberman this hour. I want to talk about a lot of things. I want to talk about what's next. Once we put away the emotion. You don't have to put it away. I still feel it. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay to be emotional. It's okay. But we do need to be hard-eyed as well. A bit cynical. I don't want to be cynical. Throw out the cynicism. Let's just say a bit realistic as well as emotional. And think about what's next. It's interesting to me in watching the Obama campaign. I was thinking about all the reasons why I was glad that Obama is our president-elect. And I was thinking back to one of my most memorable shows. Heck, if you haven't heard it, tune in. It's somewhere in my archives at radioinsidescoop.com. It's the show where I made my endorsement of Barack Obama. And it's one of those times when I have to make a hard decision, a really tough decision, I just kind of think out loud and throw everything on the board and all the pluses and all the minuses. And I was having a very tough decision back in February, or maybe it was January, it's sometime around there, in trying to decide whether I wanted Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. It was an embarrassment of riches. I like them both. I've always liked them both. I knew Hillary Clinton a bit better than Barack Obama, and that is why, at some points, I was leaning toward her. And I went through the pluses and minuses of each one, and I said, you know, I prefer Hillary's health care program over Barack Obama's. Hers is closer to universal health care than his. You know, I preferred his stance on the bankruptcy bill over hers because he was better for people in trouble. But there were tiny differences. Tiny differences. 95% of their policies were the same, and the other 5%, they were close. And I like to decide on the issues, but they were too close. It was a tie on the issues. I go through each one. If you haven't heard that show, it bears re-listening. And I came down finally to the intangibles. I decided I couldn't decide based on the merits. They were both very good people whose views closely mirrored my own. And I looked at the faces of the young people. who swarmed into Barack Obama's campaign. And I didn't see that among the Hillary Clinton supporters. I saw excited people, but not that look of hope and idealism that those in those faces of people perhaps a bit too young to have undergone the horror, the terror of the 2000 election. I mean, 2004 was bad, don't get me wrong. It was heartbreaking. But in 2004, maybe Kenneth Blackwell stole it by not having enough election machines in Ohio. We'll never really know. I don't accept the view that, without doubt, Ohio was stolen in 2004. I think it's an open question. But 2000, it wasn't open at all. There's no question Gore won. Under any system of counting, even Matt Drudge had to admit that under any system of counting, whether you count the chads, hanging chads, or you don't count the hanging chads, you count one corner, you don't count, however you count, as long as you count all the counties of Florida, Al Gore won that state, Al Gore won the election, and he didn't get to be president. I know I talk about 2000 a lot, and I do so because, personally, it was a life-changing experience for me. It was the 2000 election that roused me from my slumber, took me from my nicely paying career as a trial lawyer, had me write a little Q&A called A Layman's Guide to Bush v. Gore, which I encourage you to read today. Almost seems quaint. Got me in several books and got me writing the brief challenging the Florida lectures, brought me to Washington, made me give up all my career, changed my life. Changed America's life. 2000 for me was the end of innocence. Oh, I mean, I supported Dukakis in 88, right? I supported actually Gore in the primary and then Dukakis in 88. I had lost political campaigns before. But never this. Never this. For all my dislike of Reagan and Bush Sr., I had never seen the lawlessness. I had seen mistakes presidents made. Oh, God, yes. But I'd never seen the sheer hatred of the Constitution and disrespect for the law of the current inhabitant of the White House and the vice president that tells him what to do. And so for me, 2000, well, yeah, it was the end of innocence. It was, oh, my God, they actually stole the election. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. You know this. You know me. I have people calling to my show. They suggest conspiracies, and I say, you know what, prove it. I'll talk about it if you prove it to me, but you got to prove it. I'm not someone that jumps to these conclusions, and yet this was a conspiracy out in the open. This was the emperor has no clothes. He's walking around naked, and everyone says he has clothes, and he doesn't. The Supreme Court opinion wasn't hidden in a drawer. You could read it, and it said, even though Gore won, we're giving the election to Bush, and don't you dare cite this opinion as any precedent, because it's lawless, it's without precedent, and we don't want you to cite this precedent, because we don't want you to use this lawlessness again, unless your name is Gore and you're trying to win an election. They said so! And so I took a very large salary cut and came to Washington, and, well, the rest you know. If 2000 was the end of innocence for me, it was never the end of hope. For me, like a pilot light in a furnace, that little flame kept flickering. Kept flickering. And in the darkest days of 2002 and 2004 and even Hurricane Katrina, it kept flickering. I did believe that at the end of 8 years, this would end. I did believe that Americans still had the power in a democracy to throw out the tyrants. I never gave up hope. Maybe that's why I broke down to tears upon the election of Barack Obama, even though I knew it was going to happen last night. Ooh, night before last. Boy, it's already been 48 hours. It's hard to believe. One thing I was watching, and I'll get to what's next. That's the heart of the show. But I've got a lot to say. I got a lot of emotions going through my brain. One of the things that I was doing is I taped Fox News on Election Day. Now, maybe you think that's a little sick. Maybe it's all Schadenfreude. Schadenfreude is that wonderful German word that only the Germans could have, taking pleasure in others' misery. Schadenfreude. Use it for your worldly wise exam. But there may have been some Schadenfreude. I taped Fox News. I didn't watch it on election night. On election night, I wanted to get the real news. You know, I would flip through it from time to time, but I was watching CNN, MSNBC, ABC, CBS, all the normal mainstream news channels. But I taped it. And today I spent a lot of time watching it, watching their faces drop, as Ohio is called, and everybody knows that, yes, Obama is the next president of the United States. As I told Horn listeners on Election Day, once Ohio was called, it was over. The rest was just waiting an hour and a half for California's polls to be closed so they didn't do what they did in 1980, call the race before California's polls were closed, which is, you know, Carter was criticized 4 years later. So. But I watched Fox News, and I found, I guess, a very unsurprising twist from the most propagandistic network in the United States, the Republican News Network, the Fox Propaganda Channel, controlled by Roger Ailes. I mean, all of you know this. Prior to Obama's election, prior to the calling of Ohio, which was in effect when we all knew for sure he would be president, they were attacking him as the most liberal in Congress. They were saying he's got these connections with terrorists. They were throwing out every awful thing you could think of, from his half-aunt who, you know, was living as an illegal immigrant that he had no idea about, because let's face it, he really doesn't know his family in Kenya that much. He only knew his father for about a month when he was 10. And this is hard left, far left, Obama, radical leftist, blah, 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 typical Fox News, unsurprising to any of you. And then Ohio was called. And everybody knew that Obama was the next president of the United States. And their tone changed. Suddenly, Fred Barnes and Charles Krauthammer and all the radical right-wing conservative figureheads on Fox News started saying, you know what? Maybe Obama won't be so liberal. Maybe he'll be a moderate. Maybe he will restrain those hard-edged, left-wing, liberal Democrats who are now in strong control of the House and the Senate. Maybe, you know, he said he would bring us together. Maybe he will. Now that the election was over, these hard-edged partisans were basically pleading for mercy. And the irony is, I think they're right about the second half. I do think Obama is the kind of president who will reach across the lines, who will listen to Republicans, not do what they say, but will listen to them. Frankly, much in the same way I think I would if I held elected office. You know, maybe we all put ourselves into the shoes of someone we like and hope and trust and have faith in, but I'd like to think that I listen to people who I disagree with, just like Obama does. And while they don't often change my views, sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. Sometimes you can just do a tweak. Sometimes you can do what you want, but all right, we can give you this. That's cool. And so Fox News, which had called him the most liberal, blah, 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 suddenly they switched. It was amazing. It was so clear. It was Charles Krauthammer was saying, you know, maybe he'll run to the middle. Maybe he'll restrain the wayward Democrats. The other thing I noticed was that the difference, as I'm sure you noticed, between the McCain crowds and the Obama crowds. When John McCain gave his very gracious concession speech, frankly, the best I've seen John McCain in 2 years, 4 years, 8 years, where he finally knew he'd lost and he again could shed his, I think, ill-fitting suit of meanness and lowball politicking. I, you know, maybe he's fooling me, but I actually thought it was a genuine concession speech. I actually felt like he did all the Karl Rove strategies with his Karl Rove protege, Steve Schmidt, the same guy who apparently convinced him to choose Sarah Palin and he could shed all that and be the decent Republican that he is. And I was watching, and of course the crowd, the Palin-inspired crowd, was booing when he mentioned Barack Obama. But the people in Grant Park, Chicago, only cheered when John McCain's name was mentioned. Maybe we Democrats are simply more magnanimous in victory than the Republicans. George Bush, who of course lost the election of 2000, but started to rule from the hard right as if he had won, I think it is very different from Barack Obama, who I think will try to pull us together. But luckily, we've got big Democratic margins. It looks like we're going to get 20, maybe 25 more seats in the House. That's significant. That's significant. We're probably going to have about a 62%, maybe. Let's see. Maybe just between 60 and 62% majority of the House. That's pretty good. Only takes 67% to get a constitutional amendment. I don't know. Republicans will play ball, but I don't really know that we need a constitutional amendment right now. We don't have to overturn a presidential veto. In the Senate, we've got 57. If you haven't heard, the Oregon Senator Gordon Smith conceded today to the Democrat. That's 57 and three yet to be decided. Those three, of course, are Alaska, Minnesota, and Georgia. Georgia first. Georgia, the Republican beat the Democrat about 49.8% to 46.9%. But Georgia has a runoff system, one which I heavily support because I believe that third parties should have a chance, and runoffs allow you to vote for your preference, and then if there's no one gets 50%, you vote for the lesser of evils. And that is going to a runoff on December 2nd. We'll see what Obama does. I hope he goes down and actively campaigns for that Georgian. I don't know. He may not want to risk his political capital because that's a hard race to win. He may not have all the African Americans going out there in Georgia supporting him. And let's face it, he did lose the election in Georgia. That's a tough one. If I had to predict today, I'd say we won't win it. Then there is Minnesota. In Minnesota, Coleman leads Franken. Out of some 4.5 million votes cast, Coleman leads Franken by less than 500 votes. I think, as Al Franken put it, that's 0.04%. Minnesota, unfortunately, unlike Georgia, does not have a runoff system, which would be the fairest way to decide the election. This race was 42-42%, with a good 16%. That's a heavy chunk of change. That's 1 in 6 voters voting for the independent. And now they've got to go by the plurality. They're going to have a recount. Who'll win? I don't know. It's usually the person going into a recount ahead wins the election, but it's very close. I don't know. Obviously, I want Franken to win. I want the Democrat to win. I do not like Norm Coleman. I find him to be a snake. Personally, I'm not a fan of Al Franken. I'll tell you that. Personally, he can be a bit of a jerk. I've met the man. But his values are ones I support, and so I certainly hope he prevails. I do think, though, the Democrats could have put forward a much stronger candidate who would have easily beat Norm Coleman. So we'll see. Georgia is a probable loss. Minnesota is a tough one, too. And then there's Alaska. Alaska surprised me. Yeah, I know Alaska is the home of Sarah Palin. Yeah, I know Alaska is a red state. Yeah, I know that of all the states that said that they were voting on the issue of race, Alaska, more than any other one of the 50 states, the people who said they were voting on the basis of race voted strongly for McCain. I should say that the great majority of Americans and the great majority of American states where the people said they were voting on the basis of race voted for Obama. And not just black folk, white folk too. The majority of people in the United States that said that race was a factor in their vote chose Obama, white and black. And that's also true for the great majority of states. But the state with the largest majority that voted on the basis of race and decided against Obama was Alaska. And yet, even so, I just didn't think that Alaska would vote for a convicted felon. It turns out they voted for two criminals. Alaska had one senator and one member of the House on the ballot. Ted Stevens is a senator. Don Young is a member of the House. Ted Stevens has been convicted. Don Young's been indicted, and I expect him to soon be convicted. And everyone said, therefore, the Democrats are going to win. Ethan Berkowitz was going to win the House seat. Mark Begich, the well-respected Democratic mayor of Anchorage, was going to win his seat. And they were wrong. They were wrong. The polls showed that Stevens and Young were going to go down, but whereas the Bradley effect never occurred, the Bradley effect is the infamous idea that probably did exist 20, 30 years ago, that polls, that people voting say they're going to vote for the white guy because they don't want to admit they wouldn't vote for the black guy, but then there's a poll effect that hurts them. Which, by the way, rest in peace, Bradley effect. You're gone. If you ever existed, you certainly don't exist now. Good riddance. Goodbye to a racist relic. But apparently there's a felon effect, at least in Alaska. People don't want to admit they're voting for the guy that took bribes. They don't want to admit that they voted for the guy on the take. They don't want to admit that they voted for Mr. Corruption, but yes, they did. Thankfully, the election is not decided. It's not. Mark Begich actually has got a pretty strong chance to win. Stevens is ahead, it's true, by about 3,000 votes. However, there's some 40,000 absentee votes and a good 9,000 provisional votes left to count in Alaska. And so if he wins, let's do the math, 50,000, he only has to win about 52% of those votes to pull it out. The problem is those votes were cast early, prior probably to Stevens' conviction. So I don't know that it's going to overturn. It all depends where the votes are from. I don't know where they're from. In other words, it's possible for us to win the election in Alaska. But I think it's fair to say that all three, Alaska, Georgia, and Minnesota, they're all three uphill battles. I'd like to think we could win one of the three, just based on odds. But two is unlikely, and three is extremely unlikely. So let's just say we've got 57. Don't be too disappointed about 57. Yes, that 57 includes Joe Lieberman. I'm going to talk about him in a second. But don't be too disappointed about 57. That's pretty good. It's better than anything Bill Clinton ever had. And when Jimmy Carter had 61, well, that was a very different Democratic Party. That was a Democratic Party that still had a lot of the old Confederate Southerners. Remember, prior to the Civil Rights era, the Democratic Party was the party of the conservative, Confederate, racist South. And that was true of Democratic senators in the South in the 50s and 60s. And even in the 70s, a few of them hung around. This is very, very different. Carter's Democratic Party was hopelessly split. Not this one. Just about every Democrat in the Senate, there are a few exceptions, but just about everyone is progressive. We have a progressive majority. And I don't think we're going to see many filibusters. Let's say we have 57, which is a safe bet. On domestic issues, we can include Lieberman. And then, I think, between Olympia Snow and Susan Collins of Maine, and Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, and Norm Coleman, should he prevail in Minnesota, has got to be very careful. Obviously, with Al Franken, we're safe. I don't think we'll have too many filibuster problems. I really don't. There goes Mark being idealistic again. On foreign policy, I think we won't get Lieberman, but we will get enough other Republicans on board. Here's the thing. As long as Obama's poll ratings are sky high, and they will be in the first 6 months and probably in the first year, he can get a lot accomplished. He's got to move fast and intelligently, and I think he will. So, you know, 60, it's not like 60 is some magic number where, you know, you get a stamp that says never filibuster again. I mean, listen, there are issues where Democrats join filibusters. I mean, you know, you could have Lieberman joining a filibuster against the Democrats if it's an issue on Iraq. You could have Byrd joining a filibuster against gay rights. That wouldn't surprise me if Senator Byrd of West Virginia joined in such a filibuster. But I think we have enough. I'll tell you something. I was talking to someone, a friend of mine, about gay rights and about the horrible vote in California that still very much concerns me. But we were talking about at the federal level, and I think we can get a lot of pro-civil rights agenda through the legislature. Well, first, we have to do the economy and taxes and health care and education and energy. I mean, of course we do. Those are the big issues that Americans care about, and Obama is definitely right to go there first. But in terms of gay civil rights, I think we can pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act in a second, making it illegal to discriminate against gay people the same way it's illegal to discriminate against blacks or women or people on the basis of religion or anything else. I think we can end the silliness of don't ask, don't tell. All it takes is a bill, and I think we have a majority. And I even think we can get rid of the Federal Marriage Amendment. This is going to take a little push. But Obama said he'll do it, and I think we can give him that little push. And I even look at someone like John McCain. John McCain would vote against ending this, but would he filibuster it? I don't know. I don't think he wants to be seen as that kind of hateful person. He might vote against it, but not filibuster it. So I think we'll be okay in the Senate. I think we can get a lot accomplished. One thing I'd like to see, and it only takes a majority of the House and the Senate and the President, and you heard it here first, I would like to see the admission of the District of Columbia as a state. The state of Columbia. Finally, a populace with more people than Wyoming would get two senators and a seat in the House. And you know what? There's nothing the Republicans could do to stop it. I guess they could filibuster it. That they could do. That's one place they might join together in a filibuster. But, you know, I don't know. I don't know. We get 57 solid Democrats. And then you get someone like Arlen Specter in Pennsylvania, or if Norm Coleman wins, he in Minnesota, maybe Olympia Snow. It's kind of hard to argue that these citizens should be disenfranchised. Obviously, the hard right wants to argue it, but the few moderate Republicans left. And just think about it. Here you have a population that's majority African American. D.C. is 60 to 70% African American. Likely, there would be probably two African American senators. And that's as it should be. Blacks are 12, 13% of the nation. Let them have a state where they have regular African-American senators, and you know, after a while, maybe a white one, who knows? Wouldn't that be great? Take the jurisdiction with the least power in the United States, where even their few electoral votes barely matter because, you know, it's 90% Democratic, and give them, hey, talk about expanding the Democratic majority permanently. But that's not the reason. The reason is because it's right. It's wrong that these American citizens do not have a voice in Congress. And all it takes is a majority to admit the new state of Columbia. I don't know. The Republicans may succeed in the filibuster on that one. Meanwhile, in the House, we've got a growing majority there. That's good. Is it a progressive majority? I'm not sure. It hasn't all played out yet. But it's awfully close. With the extra 25 seats, it's awfully close. I think we can get a lot of very good things accomplished there. And it's a lot easier, of course, to get something through the House than through the Senate. I was watching the predictions, the electoral vote. Yeah, I'm still watching. It looks like North Carolina is going for Obama. And it looks like, and I think I'm the only one that predicted this, it looks like one of Nebraska's electoral votes may just go Obama's way. Wouldn't that be cool, one electoral vote from Nebraska? I want you to know I made a prediction on the Washington Post prediction site, where I predicted which states would go for whom in the election. And so far, if the Omaha electoral vote goes Obama's way, I'll have predicted every single state right except one. I did predict Missouri would go for Obama. It looks like Missouri's going for McCain. Other than Missouri, I got every jurisdiction right, 50 out of 51, including Nebraska's electoral vote. So I'm sort of proud of my predictive skills. But in terms of what's next, I've been thinking about the future. I do want to talk about Joe Lieberman. I do not think he will be the chairman of Homeland Security come January. I think that the Majority Leader, Harry Reid, will demote him for his support of John McCain. It's interesting that now that we find out that he was almost the vice president, almost certainly would be the only candidate in history had he been chosen, I think. I'm sure. The only candidate in history to run as vice president of the United States under two different party labels. I don't know what to do with Joe Lieberman. Maybe I'm in a bit of a magnanimous mood. We will need his vote in the future. Until the citizens of Connecticut turn him out, and I have reasonable expectation they will. I think he could be a chairman of some small subcommittee somewhere. If you know how the Senate or the House works, the committee chair can overrule the subcommittee chair any time, so he couldn't actually bottle up legislation or anything. He does need to pay. But at the same time, we do need every vote we can get. And maybe I'm just feeling a little magnanimous now. I don't know. I know a lot of other people are more angry than I. With the Iraq war going out of the headlines, and clearly a strong majority of the American people voting to send our troops home, I'm hopeful that actually the issue that separated Joe Lieberman from the rest of the Democratic Party will start to recede. Because on domestic issues, he was never really that bad. I don't really know why he did it, though. It still rankles me. I mean, I know he's always a close friend of John McCain, but so is Joe Biden, who's a friend of John McCain. I have to think at the bottom, Lieberman was, he felt betrayed. He felt betrayed by Ned Lamont and the primary campaign where he was beaten, let's face it. He was beaten in the Democratic Party. The majority of Democrats in Connecticut wanted him out, but not the majority of people of Connecticut. And so he fought betrayal with betrayal. In my view, demote him and be done with it. I don't want to talk about Lieberman much in the future. We need his votes, just like we need the votes of some wayward Republicans. We need the votes of Olympia Snow and Susan Collins, Norm Coleman if he is to prevail, Arlen Specter. You know, Arlen Specter is an interesting case. For a Republican, he's not that bad. I mean, I got my issues with him. Trust me, on a number of things, particularly on how he treated the Nitty Hole. But maybe he's someone that Barack Obama could put in his cabinet. He's pushing 80. He has cancer. I don't know that he'll be able to run again. He's in the state of Pennsylvania, which I think will go to a Democrat in 2010 anyway. If he goes, Ed Rendell can appoint a Democrat in his place. Kick him upstairs. Be bipartisan. Maybe we can get a Democrat there in Pennsylvania as well. It's interesting. In New England, there's not a single member of the House, now that Chris Shays lost his election, not a single member in all of New England who is a Republican. Since the founding of the Republican Party, there's always been at least one Republican from New England. Now there are none. There's still a few senators in Maine, two in Maine. Moderate, but still Republicans. And one in New Hampshire, so we'll have to get rid of them. I think we will. As for Barack Obama, I do think he's hitting the ground running. He has already chosen one of my favorite people, Rahm Emanuel, as his chief of staff. I like Rahm. I like him precisely for the reasons that a lot of Republicans don't like him. He's hard-nosed. He's an incredible political strategist. He's brilliant. He is largely responsible for the Democratic takeover in 2006. He is a middle-of-the-road Democrat, neither a left Democrat nor a right Democrat. He's not a Maxine Waters Democrat nor a Joe Lieberman Democrat. He's right in the middle of the Democratic Party, left of center, strongly agrees on issues that Obama cares about, that I care about, health care, education, the environment. He's a strong supporter of Israel. I like that. He is, I think, the kind of tough-nosed person who can be a bad cop where Obama is a good cop. And I think he'll be a terrific chief of staff. What else to say? Well, let me open the phones a bit, give you a chance to comment. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. Feel free to call in and tell me your thoughts for the future. There's one more thing I do think I need to comment on. Probably more than one, but how we think about racism in America. Yes, there was lots and lots of talk, how could there not be, about the magic of having the first African-American president elected. And it is a major, major change. Obama was criticized for saying at one point, you know, I don't look like those other guys on the first, on the $1 and $5 bills. But I want you to think about that, right? 43 presidents with their portraits hung in the White House, all white men, and then Obama. It will be a stunning difference. And it's a weird thing to talk about because obviously he didn't run as a black man. He ran as a president who happens to be a black man. He ran as the best candidate. That's why he won and Jesse Jackson never could. Still, he never ran away, at least not in my mind. He never ran away from his racial makeup. How could he? And the fact that he's half white, and he is American. He is that vast mixture, you know, maybe being white and black and Hawaii and Kenyan. To me, it just shows what a wonderful mix of people we are. You know, Kenya, Hawaii, and Kansas. Wow. Kind of hard to think of three more different places. And yet that's the heart of what makes the American dream, right? So many of us from so many different walks of life. And thinking about other, I mean, it was cool that he wasn't just black. It was cool that he had an immigrant father. I don't know if there's ever been a president of the United States. I'd like to look back and find out. I doubt there's ever been a president of the United States who had a parent who was a citizen of another country. I mean, his father never really was an American at all. He wasn't even an immigrant. I mean, he came here. He was from Kenya. He went to school for a couple years. Came back when Obama was 10. Went back to Kenya and died. And yet, the American people chose Barack Obama. Barack Hussein Obama as an authentically American leader. And that's because he is. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, all these Anglo-Saxon names. I don't know if they're rolling around in their grave or they're congratulating themselves on creating a country, an institution that indeed is greater than themselves and their ideas, that they're that Thomas Jefferson's words in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. He may not have thought of women. He may not have thought of slaves. But the idea that all of mankind is created equal is broader, stronger, more powerful than even the man who wrote those words was. And I think it'll be interesting to see how blacks and whites talk about racism. You know, I've done a number of shows on Black Talk Radio. I was on XM. I was on Sirius too, but on Black Talk Radio, I was on XM for more than a year. I was the token white guy on Black Talk Radio. And I heard a lot of the, dare I say it, pathologies of a community that has been often beaten down. I knew where Jeremiah Wright was coming from. I do. Many of the things he said were true. And the things that weren't true, and even the things that were most egregious, like the suggestion that perhaps the government put HIV in black people, which I found to be egregious and disgusting. But even that, I knew where he was coming from. These ideas come from a community that has been beaten down for centuries. I mean, they were slaves, and it's not just the slaves. I know it's been 100-plus years since slavery, but it's only been a generation since Jim Crow. My mother remembers all-white schools. Many of you maybe do, too. My mother grew up in the South and remembers water fountains and buses. This is not exactly ancient history. And so you can understand why a group of people who've been completely persecuted and abandoned by their government, systemically, not a few racist white people, but an entire government system on their back, where the law itself persecuted them. I got to tell you, there's a huge difference. There's a huge difference between some jerk, some horrific person being a bigot and mistreating you, even committing violence against you because you're black or Jewish or gay or different, and having the government do it. There is something that is wrong on a much higher height. I mean, can you imagine in 1963? Can you imagine being a little black kid and going to a police officer and saying, you know, he beat me, this white kid beat me up, and the police officer joining in with the white kid? I mean, it's upside down. It's up is down. It's like I assume dictatorships are. When the police are your enemy, not your friend. That is how African Americans understandably see the system. And even after Jim Crow was gone, there are so many. There still remain structural impediments. It'll be fascinating to see if some of these radical conspiracy theories that spread like wildfire in some of the most understandably upset populations, the poorest, the ones who are most abused in America, I wonder if some of them will go away. I wonder if President Barack Obama will help African Americans and white people finally turn the page on the darkest chapter in our history. Not that we should never study it, but that we should never live it anymore. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know this. I know that Barack Obama impressed me very much in the primaries, and by talking to people and telling them things they might not agree with. Those that listen to my decision in choosing Obama over Hillary Clinton, that tough decision I made 8 months ago, might recall that the reason I finally chose Obama, was because I could see that he was someone who could tell a group of black people in a church, watch out for anti-Semitism, watch out for homophobia, a lesson that I really wish the Californians, African Americans, had learned. He was someone that could go into a room of car manufacturers in Detroit and tell them things they didn't want to hear, raising gasoline standards. It's my hope that Barack Obama will be the president who can convey to people things they don't want to hear and make us all achieve a higher order of morality. Kevin from Brooklyn's been waiting a while. Kevin, I always appreciate when you call. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing?
Thanks. Good. What are your thoughts?
I think we're on our way. We're not quite there yet. And reason why I'm going to say that, and probably a lot of black members, because the thing is, again,
I'm not arguing racism will end. I don't want you to think I'm arguing that, because I'm not arguing that. I'm certainly not arguing racism is going to end tomorrow.
Oh, no, of course not. But right, it's tied to a bigger picture of those who have and don't, those who have not, because all too often, look how many Condoleezza Rices we have in our neighborhood. And
are there that many? Condoleezza Rice,
oh, yes.
Kenneth Blackwell, Clarence Thomas. Are there a lot of them? Because I see them as detestful human beings.
I think so. You know, to me, a moral coward is a moral coward, regardless of color.
Well, I agree, but I don't know that those folks are that common. I mean,
yes, they are. Yes, they are.
5%? No, more than that.
I would say there's a significant amount, and usually these tend to be the people who are in power. or who tend to have a powerful position, and they're just very self-serving. I went to school when I was in college with a guy from South Africa, and let's take South Africa. I don't even want to give this story. The Inkatha Freedom Party, which George Bush, when he was president, supported vehemently within the black South African movement. And he said if there was ever a party to benefit, if there was ever going to be a multiracial South Africa leadership, that would be the party I want. The Inkatha Freedom Party was the most right-wing, pro-apartheid black segment of apartheid South Africa there was.
Right.
And they wanted to maintain...
But let me ask you the broader point, though, because, yeah, there'll always be people like that. You know, there are homophobic gay people. There are anti-Semitic Jewish people. There are people like Clarence Thomas who identify with the oppressors and then help them oppress. Okay, granted, that 2 to 5% of people will always exist. My question is really more for the much larger number. The people I heard on Black Talk Radio, a group that I would guess is maybe 20% of blacks in America, maybe even that, of people who are so, or were, because I think this may change, were so disenchanted by America, by our past and our present, by things like the Tuskegee experiment, that they were willing to believe crazy notions like Jeremiah Wright's, that the government put AIDS in the black community, and this idea, you know, sort of never trust whitey, the Nation of Islam type. I have to hope that with the election of Barack Obama, some of that craziness will go down, and that those elements, which I think are harmful, are really very much harmful to themselves, because it suggests they can never make it. Why study? Why learn? You know, getting grades, that's a white thing. People who are really self-destructive. I have to think Obama will do major good for those folk.
And I pray so, too, because I teach briefly in the New York City public schools, and that's the self-destructiveness that a lot of my students had.
Right. I taught inner city school in Connecticut, and that was the first time I was
Connecticut. That's funny, but
it's the first time I was confronted with that sense of hopelessness. I remember a kid telling me, a 14-year-old kid, who I knew had been selling drugs, and I asked him about it, and he said, "I'm not going to live to see 25. Why shouldn't I get my girlfriend some golden earrings?" And I was blown away. I had no response for him at that time. I was like, from this 15-year-old. My hope is that Obama can do great good for that community. That's one of the reasons why I liked him over Hillary Clinton. I felt that he could be a role model that all those gangster rappers were. Obama could become the new role model, and that would be a wonderful thing for African Americans.
Yeah. Well, I've often encountered, like, especially when I was teaching that, because I know you guys never see me, but a brief description of me, I have a lighter complexion. Most people think I'm Hispanic rather than Jamaican. And I've often received, the only reason why I made it is because, you know, I'm light-skinned. I'm mixed race. And I've heard that about Barack Obama.
People are always going to give an excuse for their own failure to succeed. And look, there are systemic reasons. There's still racism in America. I can tell you as a radio host that not knowing the right people is very detrimental to your career. That's without doubt true, no question. But there also is the idea that a guy from a single-parent family where his mom's on welfare can, like Barack Obama, become president of the United States. Or frankly, Clinton
for
that.
Well, it's a fact now. It's not an idea. It's a fact.
And I'm running out of time, Kevin, so we'll have to continue this discussion tomorrow. But I think that Obama, Bill Clinton, the American dream is real. And no, it doesn't always work. And yes, there's still systemic racism. And yes, it still matters who you know. And yes, if your father is a president of the United States, you're going to get a big step up, right, George W. But Obama gives us hope that all of us can achieve something.
You're absolutely right.
So thank you, Kevin, for calling. Again, we'll talk more about this tomorrow. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off.